The other thing that I keep coaching myself on even yet is just to listen. Do less talking and do more listening. And they'll usually tell you where those pinch points are. If given enough time and just doing more listening than talking, and said, okay, so, and suddenly they discover that one, they're inextricably bound to each other. And two, that there's a lot more common space than there is space where they disagree. And so once we finally began to break those down, and I'm not suggesting I have the magic sauce, but it, those were the kinds of things. One, they felt like they were engaged in the process and had input into the process, and it made a difference. And two, you had the right parties around the table to say, if a question came up, there was someone who could address it.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Keep your feed safe from pathogens with VVC Premix. VVC Premix from DSM Firmenich is made up of ultra-pure benzoic acid and nature-identical flavorings to guard your feed and improve performance. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Eastman works with you to accelerate your nutritional program innovation. Start your journey with us at eastman.com. Healthier pigs are good for producers, people, profits, and planet.
You're listening to the SwineNet podcast show, where curiosity meets the cutting edge of swine production. I'm your host, Dr. Clayton Johnson, and my goal is to bring you real conversations with the people that shape the future of pig farming. From the barns to the boardrooms, we're going to chat with industry leaders who aren't afraid to get their boots dirty and push the industry forward. Whether you're listening while driving between sites or catching up on emails at your desk, really appreciate you letting us join you during your day and be your go-to place for practical conversations that power better pig production. Without further ado, let's get into today's episode. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Brett Marsh to the show. Dr. Marsh joins us with a very unique lens and perspective on our industry. Dr. Marsh grew up as a farm kid and spent decades in regulatory medicine leadership roles, most notably as the Indiana State Veterinarian. And Brett's now transitioning into academic leadership roles at Purdue University. Now, I personally know Dr. Marsh is a man who's been willing to step up when he was needed. And Brett probably doesn't like anybody bragging on him, but Brett, you've provided some pretty critical biosecurity guidance to the USDA Homeland Security staff post 9/11. You've also more recently helped lead traceability and biosecurity and diagnostic advancements in the midst of some pretty significant high-path avian influenza outbreaks in Indiana while you were the state vet. And Brett, you've really been long sought after as a go-to resource when we've had ambiguity as an industry and we've had challenges as a swine industry. And it's been, I think, Brett, because of your practical approach. You're grounded in good science. You also think about what we can actually accomplish on the pig farm. And you do a good job of bringing those things together. And Brett is now in a new role in veterinary education, helping to educate some of our best and brightest young vet students, where he's currently the dean at the Purdue College of Veterinary Medicine. And I'm going to encourage the audience to reflect on the lessons that Brett can share with us here today through his experience as both a regulator and now as a dean. Dr. Marsh is going to provide some actionable advice to all of us about the challenges and obstacles of our industry today, along with some thoughts about how we can better position ourselves for the likely opportunities of tomorrow. So, Dr. Marsh, after that introduction, thank you so much for coming on and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not sure I can live up to that introduction, but I appreciate it very much. I'm honored to be a part of this discussion today and looking forward to the questions that come forward.
Brett, let's start with a little bit on your background. What inspired you to move into veterinary medicine in the first place? What flipped that trigger to say, all right, I want to go to vet school, and then progressing into a career on the regulatory side of veterinary medicine? What kind of made you at some point realize that was a good direction to go?
Yeah, it's interesting. As I reflect back, I've kind of taken the road less traveled. And in my course, I grew up in rural central Indiana. I grew up on a small farm. And by the time I was a freshman in high school, I decided I wanted to become a veterinarian. And at the time, if you had a veterinary college in your state, that was your veterinary college. And so Purdue University was going to be my choice. And I happened to be close to Lebanon, Indiana, which is a Lebanon Veterinary Clinic. So I spent my pre-veterinary days there. And there were some great leaders in that practice. And I understood early on how important it was not only to understand the animal issues, but the people issues that go with those animal issues. And Dr. Russell Harden was an early mentor of mine. He just passed away a couple of years ago at 100 years of age. So he was a longtime mentor for me. He's a Kansas State graduate. And so he came to Indiana, and I had the good fortune of working in that practice in my pre-veterinary days during high school and into my undergraduate program here at Purdue. But that exposure, that experience, and I'll be honest with you, Clayton, one of the things that was compelling to me early on was not only the science, the importance of animals in our population, dealing with those issues and the interface with their animal owners, but it was the respect that was shown to those veterinarians in that practice by the public. And boy, this is a great profession. You could go into a lot of areas. But how highly respected they were in the community as community leaders, not only for their knowledge of the science, but their ability to work and interface with the community and be an important part of that sphere. And that's something I want to be a part of. That's important to me. So again, as a freshman in high school, I said, I think I'll go to Purdue. That'll be my college. I only applied to one college. So if they told me no, I don't know what I've done. But I was a first-generation college student. My family didn't go to college, and so it was new to me. I came to Purdue in that fall. My dad brought me to Purdue here in the family pickup truck. I had a footlocker, and everything I owned was in it. He dropped me out in front of my residence hall assignment, and you just start in. So it was a great experience getting started. Those early mentors were so important. Purdue University, of course, getting started as, again, a first-generation college student. I had started through the College of Agriculture and Animal Sciences, met some of the great professors there, and encouraged me to continue the work. So that's kind of the start of it all to say, you know, how did you even get into this line? But again, the Lebanon Veterinary Clinic, we grew up on a small farm. I was around animals. My father was in the commission livestock business at the Indianapolis Stockyards. And so it was always a pleasure to go down and visit with producers and see animals in that environment. And so I got exposed to the marketing side of things, of livestock. He was a hog buyer on the Indianapolis market for many, many years. So my dad's exposure, my mother's encouragement to go to college, and then my mentors at the Lebanon Veterinary Clinic. So a combination of a number of things, and that took me to Purdue.
What about from Purdue to a career in regulatory medicine? As I understand it, you kind of started on swine health disease programs there in Indiana, then progressed to the state vet. What inspired you down that pathway?
Yeah, it was, again, an interesting course, and I encourage our students here never to say no, because you never know which turn you might take. Actually, when I entered the veterinary program, I had worked during my pre-veterinary days on a cattle ranch in the sand hills of Nebraska, and I was interested in using my veterinary degree in cattle programs in ranch country. So I was going to go west, and even as I was a senior, a fourth-year veterinary student, I did my externship in St. Francis, Kansas, very northwestern Kansas. Worked a beef cattle practice there, feedlots, cow-calf operations, etc. So as I was matriculating through that fourth year, I thought, well, maybe my focus has been a little narrow. Maybe I need to take a look at some other options. So I began to look around, and I'd always enjoyed working with people and people who appreciate animals. And so I just took a chance and looked into public service and made contact with the state veterinarian's office at the time and also the state health department. And so I took a position with the State Department of Health in the meat and poultry inspection program. And my classmates told me I was wasting my degree, that you must be out of your mind. And I said, no, this is interesting. I can work in this sphere, work in the animal world in a little different way. As it turns out, after a couple of years there, one of the directors of that program in meat and poultry inspection became the state veterinarian. And so after he, Thomas Freese, became the state veterinarian for Indiana, I made contact with him and I said, hey, if you have anything on the live animal side of things, I'd be interested in taking a look at that. He said, well, the only vacancy I have coming up is the swine health programs. Well, I'd spent my time on the beef cattle side of things. And he said, but I have a swine slot. And I said, well, okay. So I ended up taking a totally different route, ended up in swine health. At the time, it was at the height of the pseudorabies eradication program. So I became involved in pseudorabies eradication initiatives across the state and with the country. And that was really the launch pad. And after having done that for 8 years or so, then I had an opportunity to become state veterinarian. But again, I've encouraged our students and others, say, you know, veterinary medicine may take you in all sorts of directions. I was looking at beef cattle practice and ended up going into swine health programs in a public service role and working with producers of all types across our state and country. And that was what really sold me. I said, this is where I need to be, working with extension educators, market operators, packing plant operators, practitioners of all types, and working through advisory committees and the importance of getting grassroots input into a process and a program, et cetera. And I just really enjoyed all that work and the opportunity to use my veterinary degree in a different way.
Well, Brett, I think your legacy as a state vet there in Indiana, from my perspective, as a licensed vet in Indiana, looking at it, I see you as having done a wonderful job of helping to coordinate the activities and resources and functions of all those groups you just mentioned. You know, the producers, the allied industry that supports the producers, the packers, you know, and certainly your role on the regulatory side. You were often welcome at meetings where all those people are represented and really seen as somebody that could drive collaboration, that could find the thread, the needle kind of between all those different lenses of where's the common themes of what we all want and what we can accomplish. How do you do that? I mean, how do you, I'm trying to highlight that I think you're more effective than most at that. And I think a lot of us could learn because there's times where everybody's going to step up and lead, you know, maybe across functions. Maybe that's just departments in your business or across entire different businesses like you did. But what's the secret sauce to making that work? How do you get folks to work together?
Yeah, well, it's it works sometimes, and other times it's a little more challenging, isn't it? But one of the things I learned early on in my swine health programs area, again, we were working on pseudorabies, and it became apparent to me in some of the early meetings that those who were in the breeding stock business didn't understand the feeder pig business, didn't understand the marketing business or the packing plants, et cetera. So in our advisory committees, we'd bring them all and say, so who have we missed? There's surely somebody else. Well, there may be extension educators that were missed in the conversation. Well, let's bring them in. And it was interesting because the advisory committees that we established were not formal. There were no bylaws. There were no dues paid or anything like that. We just simply said, if you'd like to be a part of this conversation, we're meeting on such and such a date. And it was really an interesting time that we would have a room full every time. And they also understood that, and I think it was an important part of our conversation with them, that they were the ones who would decide how we would move forward. You decide. We'll take it through the rulemaking process or whatever was necessary. But that advisory committee decided every rulemaking and action that went to the full Board of Animal Health for official action. And so they soon learned that they were the ones who determined their own fate and could play in that role. And I think it was really a powerful thing. It is just to listen, do less talking and do more listening. And they'll usually tell you where those pinch points are. If given enough time and just doing more listening than talking, and said, okay, so, and suddenly they discover that one, they're inextricably bound to each other, and two, that there's a lot more common space than there is space where they disagree. And so once we finally began to break those down, and I'm not suggesting I have the magic sauce, but those were the kinds of things. One, they felt like they were engaged in the process and had input into the process, and it made a difference. And two, you had the right parties around the table to say, if a question came up, there was someone who could address it. And if not at that time, we'll get it addressed the next time. But I think it was a very powerful opportunity for me to learn how the dynamics of working a program and engaging all the necessary parties and doing more listening than talking.
Brett, you did a great job of describing, how to create buy-in. And I loved where you said that, we were able to tell these folks that it's your process and you've got the decision-making authority. But certainly at times in your career, there's been moments where you had to bring a process to somebody. And I think, probably the high path avian influenza challenges would have been something like that, where maybe you had to tell a producer, look, you got to get a PREM ID. You got to have traceability. You got to have a biosecurity program I can trust before I'm going to let you put birds back in these barns. How do you transition your approach in those situations where it is a directive? You have a formal program that needs to be followed, and maybe somebody that's not too excited to hear that.
Yeah, and I think that I really credit the team that we had at the Board of Animal Health, because many times they were on the front line to deliver those messages. I'm really proud of the folks that we had, because there were some difficult assignments over time. One of the things that we use as kind of a mantra within our organization was getting to yes. How do you find a way? It's easy in regulatory medicine to say no. Mm-hmm. No, we can't this. We're understaffed. We don't have the money, or the rules don't allow it, or whatever. And I think that was really the fun part for our team, was how do you get to yes? You can't always, but there's an opportunity to find that. And even in some of those most difficult times, when you're dealing with major disease outbreaks, high path AI as an example, birds being depopulated, and great loss of market opportunities, mental health stressors on producers and their families, and even our own people, my own staff, et cetera. So listening to those kinds of issues, finding ways to address them, understanding the consequences of our actions, because, again, producers are working hard to keep, in this case, birds alive. And yet we're depopulating massive numbers of birds, and it's right on their farm properties. It's a difficult thing to do. And the pork industry experienced this in COVID in a different way. It wasn't an animal health event, but because of the human health event, it caused backups on farms, et cetera. And the impact, and I think we learned it happens very quickly. It didn't take long. Once those systems were shut down, and so I was in a role here, as many others were across the country, trying to keep that product moving, packing plant closures because employees couldn't report to work, or at least in my experience early on, was when the schools closed. So someone had to stay with the children. So you had employees who were staying home. So suddenly there was no one to work, and the packing plant's closing and backs up at the farm. So I think it was a real life example for the pork industry, even though it wasn't an animal health event, on how quickly things can unravel. And so, yes, there are times when those messages are difficult and challenging. But I hope that in our work, even with the high path outbreaks, et cetera, that the preparedness planning on the front end had prepared producers and others to say, okay, we knew it was coming, or the potential was there. And these are the things we've done in advance to prepare ourselves financially, and logistically, mentally, all those pieces to say, okay, we knew this could happen. You told us, and we tried to advise. And that was one of our goals early on, is to make sure that producers were aware of what those tasks were and some of the challenges they might be met with.
Brett, you lived the COVID situation with the marketing challenges we have. You've lived the high path AI situation. compare and contrast those a little bit for a pork producer, just in that, you know, pork producers, they did practice depopulation, they did practice disposal, maybe not with the same timeline and urgency that we'd have with a foreign animal disease. But we didn't practice things like permitting movements and, you know, permitting feed movements, things like that. What are some things that you think the pork industry needs to be aware of that in a high path AI situation would be above and beyond challenges than what we dealt with COVID? What are some of the lookouts you'd share with us based on your experiences with foreign animal disease control?
Yeah, and that's a great point. And we actually have done some exercises with producers to say this is how permitting will work. Just something as fundamental as, can you do electronic signatures to keep documents moving? It doesn't have anything to do with depopulation, but the ability to continue to move a product when you can, if you happen to be in a control area. We did an exercise in Southeast Indiana, and I thought we were going to make it simple. They said, well, let's use a finishing floor. We'll use it as an example of how we would depopulate, go through the whole disposal process, et cetera. So it was a 5,000 head finisher, a rather new building, et cetera. And we got to the building as a part of this exercise, and you're much more familiar with this than I, but the only way in and out of that building was a loading chute and a man door. There are no roll-up doors. There's no way you can't get in these buildings. And so I'm standing there and saying, 5,000 head.
It's a lot to go through one door.
It's a lot to go through one door. And so there were all sorts of conversations about just the depop and disposal on what I thought was going to be simple. We didn't have sows and crates. We didn't have any of that. It's just a finishing floor, but you can't get in it. And so do we move the animals out of the buildings for depopulation? Are we using, and there are no pretty ways to go about depopulation, but is it foam? Is it electrocution? Is it whatever all those are? But again, having those thought processes in mind by producers, we'd actually take a satellite image of a barn and would ask a producer, says, is this your building? Yes, that's my building. Okay, so what's your plan for this building? And how do we go from there from this perspective? And we can talk about lines of separation and buffer areas and those sorts of things. But just logistically, how would we go about that task? And then to your point, we could talk about permitting and the other pieces necessary to move product if you're not the infected site, but you're caught up in one of these control areas. So doing that in advance, I think, is really, really important. And we've done an exercise along that way. And that's why I think it's really important for programs like SHIP, SHIP can talk about what's going on when things are negative, and then you can shift to the red book of USDA when things go wrong and you have a positive, then we can at least work in two spheres. Because as you well know, after ASF was diagnosed in China, I don't know how many committees, task forces, advisory, there are all sorts of groups come together. And I said, boy, if we could just get it down to two, one is the red book when things go wrong, and the other is SHIP, and we can figure out. And what I really like about SHIP is, much like I was mentioning with advisory committees, the producers get to decide.
Yeah.
So how would you like for this to proceed? What resolutions, what recommendations, what standards would you like to have in place as we move through that program? And that's what I think is exciting about it for our industry, because, again, they can be engaged in those planning processes before we ever get to the problem.
Practice makes perfect, and those open planning exercises are valuable no matter what your goals are.
No matter what. Yeah, that's right.
Eastman serves veterinarians and nutritionists in agrochemical and animal health industries by helping them select, evaluate, and implement innovative nutritional programs. Eastman works with your team to customize your gut health approach in feed and water. Eastman's approach addresses nutritional and bacterial challenges and finds new ingredient preservation and hygiene solutions. Explore ways to accelerate and innovate your programs. Contact the animal nutrition team at eastman.com.
Brett, let's talk about your new adventure a little bit there at the university. Did your background in public service influence your decision to move into the academic world there at the university, or was it something else that drove you that direction?
Well, I think it was when the opportunity came up, the dean's vacancy came open, and I was actually nominated for it. And someone says, why don't you consider that? And I'm like, I'm not sure that that's, you know, I've not grown up in the academic sphere. I've not been a faculty member, et cetera. And they said, no, why don't you consider it? Because, again, to your point early on, I may come with a different perspective. And so I went through that process and was fortunate enough to be selected. And I've been here for about 8 months now. It's been a great learning curve for me. I've told people that Purdue University taught us to be lifelong learners, and I'm just trying to uphold my end of the deal. So it's been great. Faculty, staff, and students have been wonderful to work with. They've been patient with me while I learned this new process. The Central University has been very supportive as well. But it's an exciting time. I think there's really great opportunities. We have very capable students. I'm excited about the prospects for them and the future of veterinary medicine for them, as it has been for me. And again, I can offer, as we are today, kind of my experiences and what other opportunities in addition to a private clinical practice might be. But it's really been heartening. I'll have to share a story, though. When I first came to campus, I was told, I said, well, you need to go to a certain building here on the campus to get a picture ID. And I said, okay. So I walked over and they told me to sit in a chair. They take my picture, and within 2 or 3 minutes, I'll have a picture ID so I'd be an official Purdue employee. And I said, okay. So I got my ID within a few minutes. And I said, well, I understand I can get a parking permit here in this building as well. They said, yes, that's true. Drop down to the lower level and go to the far end and they'll get a parking permit for you. So I went down there and I explained to them. I said, well, I'm a new Purdue employee and I need a parking permit here on campus, et cetera. And they said, do you have a picture ID? Yes, I have a picture ID. It's just been given to me. So I handed it to her and she worked at her computer a little bit. And she said, yes, but you're not in our system and I can't issue a parking permit. And I said, well, okay. She said, well, actually, I could issue a guest permit, but I'll need a letter from your dean.
You got a pen and paper?
So I said, do you have a napkin? I'm happy to fill some. So getting used to the new process and the new system, but it's really a lot of fun. Working with the admissions committee and seeing this young talent come into our program. We have 84 students that enter our program this fall. So we have 84 members. 52 of them are from Indiana. So 52 of the 84 are Indiana residents. The other 32 are from all over the United States. And it's interesting, particularly for me, is that, as it turns out, 25% of the class are first-generation college students, as I was. And 37% of those students did their undergraduate work here on the Purdue West Lafayette campus. So it's and about 21% are men. So taking a look at all the dynamics that are going on in the program. So it's an exciting time where, in addition to what's going on the West Lafayette campus, Purdue has an Indianapolis campus in central Indiana. So we're taking a look at what opportunities our college might have there. And just a little south of the Purdue Indianapolis campus is the new Elanco World Headquarters. They're global headquarters. And so our president here at Purdue has announced a One Health Innovation District that will be established adjacent to the Elanco facility. And they would like our College of Veterinary Medicine to have an important role on that campus. So not only what's going on in West Lafayette on the Purdue home campus, but also in Indianapolis as well. In addition to our hospitals, which are just 3 years old here on this campus, we have an equine specialty hospital in southeast Indiana. And then I'm also responsible for the Animal Disease Diagnostic Laboratory. So that's part of the college here as well. So lots of opportunities to learn, but I have been involved in a number of committees and activities on the campus, having been an alum. So I've been back here a number of times, but it's a great honor for me to serve as dean.
Well, and we know you're going to do good work there. There's a lot going on at the university because there's a lot going on in the world. But I'm glad you brought up the One Health concept. Brett, I think One Health is a term that a lot of big producers and folks in the industry have heard. But maybe admittedly, if you asked us all to define it, I don't know that any of us would get it right. And we'd have a lot of variation with it. So talk to us about, particularly swine-specific related initiatives for One Health, or what should pig producers know about One Health, and what are some practical objectives of that collaboration you've got with Elanco down there?
Yeah, and I think you're right. The definition is provided by different people in different ways, but basically we're taking a look at animal health and human health and how those interface and the important role amongst and between all these various facets, whether it's plant health, environmental health, et cetera. But particularly in ours, between animal and human health, I think there are important linkages that we want to make sure that we consider. Fortunately, we're not dealing with a lot of zoonotic disease in swine, but there are potential globally for threats to our populations here in the United States that we see need to keep on our radar. And I'm intrigued, of course, about everything, in, whether it's in small animal or equine or other spheres as well, where we talk about the One Health interface. In Indiana, 70% of the population, 70% of the households in our state have a pet. So you have a lot of interface. And of course, that goes on. And then we have a consuming public of lots of protein. And Indiana has been a major protein producer. And so we're number one in commercial ducks. We're number two in eggs, number three in turkeys, number five in swine. And we're the smallest state geographically west of the Appalachian Mountains. So we're not a big state, but there's a lot of animal agriculture going on in our state, and swine's a big part of it. And whether we're actually producing those swine in Indiana, they may traverse our state because of our interstate system. So there's a lot of movement through our state. So there's lots of opportunity. Influenzas are one that we are always interested in. We've worked with Dr. Andy Bowman over the years with exhibition swine and influenzas. And of course, we've dealt with those kind of issues over time. But I think it's another example of how we can utilize the relationship between human and animal health to appreciate what's going on in one species. It might impact another. And it illustrates that role that we can work together. We actually have the Indiana University School of Medicine collaborates with our College of Veterinary Medicine here. So we have medical students just across the street from our veterinary campus. So there's opportunities not for not only students, but also faculty to interface in this One Health sphere. So I'm excited about the president. It was one of the things that attracted me to this role when the president of the university announced this One Health Innovation District in Indianapolis and one of the pillars of the campus over the next several years. I said, yeah, we've dealt with One Health issues over the years. I've often said the veterinarians were doing One Health before we called it One Health. We've been doing this for a long time and been involved in this in a number of ways, and I'm excited to be just a small part of it.
Brett, you mentioned the diagnostic laboratory there at Purdue University, and obviously you've worked with them as a customer. Now you've got a different role there. Have you been there long enough to kind of tease out, are there any better ways for us to handle the diagnostic submissions, particularly in those regulatory type situations, the Red Book type deal, where these results are important, the timing is important, the accuracy is important. Are there nuggets there we can get better, or do you feel like that process is pretty good as it is today?
Well, I think there are areas for improvement, certainly. I want to make sure, based on our experience with HiPath, if we were to get African swine fever, there are some things that we need to improve upon. We have a great team at our diagnostic laboratory. We're actually getting a new LIM system, a laboratory information management system, that's being installed as we speak to better facilitate the movement of data and information. That's going to help us a lot. It's something that we've needed for some time. One of the things that our laboratory is a part of the National Animal Health Laboratory Network, and a lot of producers and veterinarians are saying, well, as a part of that network, if we send samples from Indiana to, say, Ohio State's lab or University of Illinois' lab, then we'll get that. But based on my prior experience, we have a direct electronic link between our laboratory at Purdue and the Indiana State Board of Animal Health. That electronic link doesn't exist with the other non-laboratories. And so you can send the samples there, but I might get it back in a PDF or something like that, so it's not as usable. So that's why we want to make sure we're geared up and ready for that event in Indiana through our diagnostic laboratory. So those are the things we've learned from HiPath that could have a significant impact on our pork industry. And those preparedness initiatives on the front end will save us a lot, not only time, but a lot of money as well.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Fortiva, creating ingredients for impact to support animal resilience and health. Learn more at FortivaImpact.com. Vaccinova, formulate to your needs. Custom-made vaccines.
SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions. Uniferon 200 from Pharmacosmos, the iron dextrin for baby pigs, which promotes faster growth. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost pig health and performance. A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adisseo's portfolio of products includes Nephironine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adisseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adisseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adisseo at www.adisseo.com.
We've talked a lot, Brett, so far about foreign animal disease risks and how to handle those red book type situations. What other challenges do you see that with the U.S. swine industry where academia can help to bring resources and bring solutions, maybe outside of the world of foreign animal disease?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're in the process right now of recruiting a swine researcher to our college because that's where the answers are. We have to continue to explore and find better ways, whether it's in animal health or nutrition or housing or genetics and all these spheres. But we're excited about bringing this new position on board. We're in the negotiations right now to bring this person on board. The research capabilities of our university are robust, and we want to make sure that we're providing the services to the industries we serve. It's one of the things that I think was helpful to us when I served at the Board of Animal Health is it's very fundamental, but don't forget who you work for. And I think that's really one of the fundamental things for us here. And if it's research or service or producing practice-ready veterinarians in swine practice, that's what we're in the business to do. And we're not in the business to run a practice. We're not in the business to do those kind of things, but we can produce high-quality practice-ready veterinarians and high-end research. So those are the things that excite me. We're in a process now as the federal government is deciding what they will fund and what they will not. So we're in that mode right now. But overall, as a university, Purdue University's shift in their funding research from federal agencies is only down 1%. And so we've been very fortunate in that regard. Some of the state budget constraints, we'll be dealing with some of those as we work over the next fiscal year. But again, I think it's important for us to continue to reflect back, just as I did in those old advisory committees, to listen to the customer and listen to the people that we serve and say, okay, what is your expectation of us? And how do we get to yes? And so some of those same fundamentals apply here in academia as well, and I'm excited to exercise those here.
Do you think, Brett, will evolve more back towards the extension model that maybe previous generations were familiar with? And I say that, I used to work at the Mashoffs, and one of the things that Wayne Mashoff would always say is, I just went to the extension meetings, and I just came back home and did what they said to do. He was trying to deflect any sort of, accepting the credit for building such an impressive system. But I think there was truth to that. And, admittedly, those sort of extension processes don't exist at the same level they did decades before. Do you think we'll migrate back towards that? Or do you think we'll need to just come up with clever ways of delivering good, high quality information, but not the same drive to the university and sit there for a lecture approach?
Well, I hope extension survives, but my guess it will look different in how we go about our process moving forward. I wouldn't be surprised in our state, for example, as the Farm Service Agency's offices have consolidated where one office is providing services to multiple counties, we might end up with some of those kinds of things, depending on how we move forward. We have an extension reach from our college. I want to keep that going. I don't think it's as robust as it could be, so I think it's a good opportunity. But no, you're right. It's been a cornerstone for a long time. And harkening back to my swine days, I was invited by extension educators to county meetings over and over, to talk about the pseudorabies mission or whatever it might be. Yes, it'll look different. but we want to preserve it and make sure that we have a conduit between our university and those who are actually applying, whether it's research or other practices. So, yeah, I think it'll look different. I've talked to the dean of the College of Agriculture here at Purdue, and he's directly responsible for the extension reach from our university and looking at new ways to deliver a message to a new population.
That's excellent to hear. Brett, we gotta get close to the finish line here. I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but one of the wrap up questions I wanted to ask you was, you have such a unique perspective of veterinary medicine, the industry, the government side of things. What advice do you have, Brett, for young veterinarians or even veterinary students that are thinking about their career options, whether it be public service, practice, academia? How would you advise a young person make the decision for their career? You know, how would you advise them to think about those opportunities and consider them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, one, I think, is just be curious about what those opportunities are. They come in all sorts of fashions. And, you know, when I took my role as in public service, I had a veterinarian say I was crazy. And then I had a classmate call me when I took this position. He said, Brett, you must be out of your mind.
No more.
But the profession provides enormous opportunities. And I think it's really unique. Yes, it's different than it might be in the past. In Indiana, for example, in the swine industry, when we were testing to sell feeder pigs years ago, we had 10,000 herds tested in that program. Well, it won't ever be that way again, and we get that. But we still have a very robust swine industry, and we want quality veterinarians coming out of our program to service that industry. So I encourage them to be curious and to take advantage of individuals such as yourself to learn what practice looks like, or learn what the Board of Animal Health looks like through internships. Or we used to have students come through, might just be during holiday break.
Sure.
Just come for a week and see what this is all about. A day. Yeah. And just come and see. And even though it might be dry and boring to some people, I would invite them to a board meeting. I said, you get a chance to hear the debate and discussion around the table on, say, animal health policy. And not many get a chance to see that. And if you're interested in any of a number of branches of our profession, I encourage them to take a look at. But find those mentors or those that can give you some specific direction and instruction. And I've also encouraged a student, I don't know how it is for you, Clayton, but, you know, I still seek mentors. I mean, it's not just for those students as they're coming through, but I still rely upon people to help guide my thought processes, and I seek them out today. And again, try to do more listening than talking. But I'm very bullish on our profession and its opportunities for the future. We had 1,958 applications for 84 slots. And so there's great demand and great interest, and we're determined to produce the best and the brightest to continue to support these sectors.
That's a tremendous message, Dr. Marsh. We're blessed to have you in our veterinary community, and pork producers are blessed to have you as a member of the overall pork industry. I can't thank you enough for everything you've done throughout your career to help the pork industry and helping veterinary students today, and for coming on and having this chat with me here today.
It's been my great honor. I'm really pleased to get a chance to visit with you. And guys, come over to Purdue, and happy to host you here.
I appreciate that opportunity, and we'll have to look at the schedule for football and basketball season and see if we can't find an Illinois-Purdue game, and we'll come over and kill a couple birds with one stone.
That works for me. Let's make it happen.
Well, thanks, Brett, for coming on the show and joining us on the Swine It podcast show. We really strive to dive deep and help our audience stay informed and educated and inspired about the swine industry journey. And Dr. Marsh, I can assure that you've helped us to accomplish that today. To the audience, if you did enjoy today's episode with myself and Dr. Marsh, please share it with your team. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Take 2 seconds and give us a 5-star rating and leave us a review. It does a ton to help more producers and swine professionals like yourself discover the show. For Dr. Brett Marsh, I'm Dr. Clayton Johnson. Thanks for spending some time with us today, and we certainly hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
You feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10-an-hour tasks to focus on more $1,000-an-hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.